And actually, very interestingly enough, this Catholic school that my father attended, one being very prestigious one at the time, Los Escolapios, taken over by the government, of course, was all shut down. There was no room for Catholic education, for Christian education, something that had been such a fundamental part of the Cuban culture, with so many Cubans who were and still are Catholic, but are unfortunately cannot or don't necessarily practice their religion freely. So at that time, my father, when Castro came and took his business, my father joined a small group of men, and they were trying to figure out what's the best way to protest this government. How can we go through and end this Castro reign? At that point, the Castro regime imprisoned these men. There were about 13 men, and several of them were executed by the firing squad. And my father, fortunately, was one of those who was spared. But he has these very incredible stories of his time in the Cuban prisons, just horrifying stories of his time in the prison, and it's something that I think has impacted and definitely impacted my life, and it's a story that not only do I share, that I shared with Matt, but obviously with our children as well.
Now, was he tortured?
Yes, he was. The way, it's interesting, because my father's a quiet man. He didn't, he basically would talk about his time in prison very, just not too often. As I got older, he finally opened up, and he was able to share with me the stories. And he was put into solitary confinement for 3 months at a time, stripped naked into what they would call these refrigerator types of rooms, where they would throw easily four or five men together there, and they were there for days, if not months. And it really was something that I think you almost have to be incredibly psychologically strong to be able to survive.
But naturally, it's going to leave some scars.
Yes, it does. It's interesting because I think for my father, he's a type of man, Deal, that he prayed so much during his time in jail. And I have to say something. He was not what you would call the most religious man.
But he learned to be religious.
He learned to be religious. And there was a Virgin Mary. It was our Lady of Las Mercedes. And she was the Virgin of the political prisoners. So it's the Mother of God, the image of this Virgen of Las Mercedes. And it was the one that the Cuban prisoners, many of them, would pray to. And so he made a promise to her, and not many people know the story, that if he were to survive and be able to leave the Cuban prison safely and rejoin with my mom, that he would name his first daughter Mercedes.
Oh, no. That's wonderful.
And he would always have a statue of her in his house. And so he was supposed to serve 13 years, ended up serving 6 years, gets out of jail, he gets to Miami where he's with my mother, and of course, and I was born 1972, and I'm the first born mm-hmm. daughter, and so my name, hence, is Mercedes. And to this day, he has that statue that he's had for 43 years at his house, and I actually have a painting of the Virgin in my home. And the Virgin is just this beautiful picture, and Deal, when you come to my house, you can see it.
Wow.
Of the shackles of the prisoners in one hand.
Okay.
And so, really, I think it was his spiritual, his commitment to God, his commitment to the Virgin Mother.
What's your father's name?
Jose. We call him Pepe. Jose Viana.
Jose Viana. And how old is he now?
He's 81.
Is he in good condition?
He's rock solid. He was just with us for Thanksgiving, and it was what was very special is that I was the one that got to wake him up and share with him the news that Fidel Castro had died.
Oh, really?
Yes. And
tell us all about that.
He was he teared up, and there was a smile. There was almost a sense of relief from my father. He was, I think for him, it had been such a long journey. where there was had been so much pain. I mean, it was the fact that when he did come, not only did he have the pain and the suffering in jail, but then he comes to the United States, and his sister and his mother and many of his relatives were still in Cuba, and there was that division of the family, and then that whole struggle of trying to get my family, the rest of our family, out of Cuba. And it was, he knows the damage that this one dictator created in his land that he loved so much, and that he had to give everything up. I mean, I think it's sometimes people don't realize that, you know, that you literally leave everything behind. You leave your photos, you leave your jewelry, you leave, you know, I think he was only able to get his wedding ring out and like an apple in his pocket. It is truly leaving your life.
How did he get out? I mean, that surprises me. They let him go.
Well, the way in the Castro regime how it works is that the political prisoners, they want them out of the country, right? They don't want them to reassemble within Cuba to form the opposition movement. So it was negotiated through a deal where he was able to get out through Costa Rica, and then they were accepting the political refugees into the United States at the time. And so my mother, who was actually born in Spain, so she had a Spanish citizenship, had left earlier with her mother, and my father's brother, Orlando, and they were in the United States. And so my father then, after he served his time, and he was actually an interesting prisoner, at several years into his jail term, he ended up becoming a bit of a project manager in the jail, because prisoners would come work. And so he, who just has a natural, you know, it's just a natural entrepreneur, and he was the one who would manage the prisoners. So I think that by the end, he served his time. The guards knew that he did his work, and then at that point, he was able to be released and come to the United States.
Did he know Castro well?
No, he had never met Castro. He was not part of what they would say the initial group of people who would basically supported Castro, or part of the political offices, individuals who were like representatives or part of the government in the Castro world. He was a simple businessman, wanted to do well, worked hard, was just one of these men who just had a natural ability to build successful businesses. And when he did it, and let me tell you, I mean, he came from a family where his mother his mother and father owned a laundromat. Like, she had third grade education. You know, this was a man who had big dreams. He wanted to get his degree in public administration to eventually become a diplomat at some point. He had very big dreams.
So he wasn't part of the Batista elite.
No, he was he would be considered your average businessman in Cuba. He owned a factory that would make little boxes made of cardboard. He had an accounting office. He owned, he helped my grandparents with the laundromat. I mean, he had all these businesses that he just worked to, you know, make money and live out his dream. But then it all really, when he saw where Fidel Castro, how he was taking over just the industries and making it known that he was in charge and that he was willing to destroy everything along his path, whether it be the church, whether it be capitalism, anything in his path, to set this communist ideology and really this dictatorship, my father knew that at that point that his nation was in trouble and that he needed to fight back and needed to do something.
Well, Mercedes, and I'm talking to Mercedes Slapp, who is a Fox News contributor, among many other things, and who I've known since she was in the George W. Bush White House and before she married Matt Slapp, had five beautiful daughters. The question of the day is this, but I want to say this is a question I've had since the 60s, because I was old enough to see what Castro had done and where he was, you know, kind of watch where he went with it, with the killings, the imprisonments, the tortures, and all that. Why did Castro ever become a hero to Americans, whether they're liberal Americans or progressive Americans? How did he become a hero? Because now that he's dead, in the aftermath, we've probably seen more encomiums to Fidel than we have honest assessments of his long life as a dictator, brutal dictator.
Yeah, I found it surprising that, not surprising, I mean, surprising really how I think President Obama reacted to his death, with sort of history will dictate, will be the judge.
And, well, that's what Castro said of himself.
Right, exactly. It was like this political correctness and this sense of missing the point of how Fidel Castro did everything he could to undermine the United States and to undermine anything that was close to being democratic or supporting anything associated with freedom, whether it be political freedom or religious freedom. And so I think that there is this the sense of the left that Fidel Castro was a bit of a superhero pushing forward the leftist ideology, the Marxist philosophy of the ideals of the left, where everyone lives equally, right? There's this whole mentality that having this idea of competition and being,
which is all
bad idea,
you know, which is all maybe a good idea, but what he did actually was became the Trotsky of Cuba.
That's right.
You know, he took over in the name of justice, fairness, and all of this, but he became a brutal dictator who, he didn't bring wealth, he didn't bring development.
No, and he blamed all that. The United States. He said, because of this embargo, it's why you don't have wealth. But the reality is, and this is where we are in terms, I call it the two Cubas, is that you look at the facilities for those who are following the communists, the Cuban military, those in leadership, they have the A-plus medical facilities, quality facilities that you can imagine. If you do, for the rest of the Cuban people, you should see the pictures, Deal.
So he's just replicated that which he overturned.
Exactly.
Except without the prosperity.
Right.
Right.
And taking out the opportunity for individuals to develop from an economic standpoint and be able to build their businesses, allow for capital to come into Cuba. The only way that capital comes into Cuba or any sort of investment is if you deal, and this is in the Cuban Constitution, you deal directly with the state entity. That is your point of entrance into Cuba. It is not a person-to-person, business-to-business interaction. It is clearly if you want to have any business dealings with Cuba, it is clearly you have to do this with the state, with the government.
So it's pure socialism.
It's pure socialism. And, of course, because it's an island of its size, you're talking 11, 12 million people, he can control it. It's the ultimate control. And I just recently spoke to someone who went on a cruise over to Cuba, and he was fascinating to listen to, and he said that even the tour guides are all following, touting the communist line and mm-hmm. paint this just inglorious picture of Fidel Castro. And it's just how the reality is which is that if you go to school in Cuba, you are learning the communist, the Marxist, ideology. It is Fidel Castro as sort of the king. There is no difference of there should be little to no difference of opinion, and that's how he ruled for so long, for the nearly six decades. And now that Raul Castro's in charge, there is not much of a change.
What if somebody who admires Fidel Castro, and I've been thinking about this all day, knowing I was going to talk to you, and I read a little bit and watched some documentaries to get ready. What if someone said to you, well, okay, yes, he did all that, but he overturned a very corrupt, sort of internally controlled colonial system that was in the hands of a few elite, and that, you know, the people were being abused, they were being used cheap labor. They weren't sharing in the profits. In other words, he got rid of what was, objectively speaking, not a fair and just society.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's always that argument. It's so funny that you said that, because there was this, in social media, this whole idea of saying, well, Batista was just such a horrific leader in Cuba. I think you would, if you were to ask my father, if you were to ask Cubans who lived during that time, the other argument would have been at least there was a thriving economy.
At least there was some freedom.
Exactly, and that part. Look, the Batista government was far from perfect. But they traded it in, and Batista ran. I mean, he fled Cuba.
Yes.
He was a wimp, in my opinion, to leave the island the way he did.
Would he go off with six plane loads of his buddies or something?
Exactly. So I find that to then fall into the hands of what you would, that someone who would fundamentally change and try to change the mentality of the Cuban people and take away their freedoms. And so I think that anyone, and I say this because I even read that the United Nations Secretary General called Castro, that, you know, a hero for the struggles for social justice. It's, I mean, are we kidding ourselves? There is no social justice. There is no we know that he ordered the execution of thousands of Cubans. We know that he...
We have pictures of him shooting people in the head.
Yes, of senselessly torturing not only men, but women. I met one woman just recently down in Florida who had been in jail for 25 years for speaking up against Castro. And so this is where the left should not be, they should not get away with this, because that is not social justice. That is not allowing for freedom in Cuba. And it's why it's aggravating to me that when you look, for example, at the way President Obama has approached this Cuba issue, I find it to be a bit one-sided, and I don't think it necessarily stresses these critical issues of human rights, which I think I really pride myself of being an American, to know that we do what we can to protect, you know, I know our freedoms, our religious freedoms, our political freedoms. And so you would hope that other nations would do the same.
Well, you say aggravated. That must be an understatement.
Well, I think for aggravated is a good place to start. I think it's because in President Obama's mind, it's this idea that by having this dialogue and conversation with Raul Castro, that it will fundamentally change things in Cuba. And, you know, it's interesting in reading through some of the commentary from individuals in Cuba who would not state their names because they were concerned that they would be caught, is the fact that they know that that change is really to benefit the government and not the Cuban people, right? Because if you're a Cuban, you only can follow one way and one way alone, and that is the Castro way. And so that is how they try to indoctrinate you since you're little. That's how, you know, if you're a loyal communist, then you get the perks. If you're not, then you're on your own. And so and the other thing that the Castro regime has been able to do is that these are individuals and families who they're surviving on 1 gallon of milk a month, you know, on
right now, right now.
It's the rations. They are like, economic conditions are so bad. It's the rations. You show up, you get in line, and you get what you can get at that point.
Would you ever go as a tourist to Cuba under Raul?
No, absolutely not. Because
why would you not go?
It's funny. I had a friend of mine ask me today. She's like, my husband really wants to go to Cuba. What do you think? And so because I do feel that the money goes straight into the hands of the Cuban government.
Right.
You know, I know that many Cubans send the way many of these Cubans are living, they're living off of the remittances of the families in the United States. It's similar to what you see in Mexico. I mean, it's about
which started in the started after the breakdown with the USSR. They had to get new revenue in there. Now, the analogy that keeps hitting me is Stalin. With Stalin, you had all this generation of British intellectuals who thought Stalin was, you know, the great savior of Russia and so forth. But and most of them repudiated it, with the exception of a few who still hold on to the myth of Stalin. But slowly after Stalin died, his own circle began to let people know who Stalin really was and what really happened. Do you ever see that happening? I mean, eventually Gorbachev just completely, you know, eliminated the Communist Party, but that took 30 years,
yeah,
I mean, 35 years. Do you think that'll ever happen in Cuba?
You know, I'm hopeful. I do believe that when Raul Castro dies, it does create an opportunity for those who have stayed in Cuba, who are the political opposition, to rise up. I think I think the difficulty is that there is the Cuban military stronghold, which will try to ensure that the political opposition is not able to get to really effectively organize. I do think that the benefit that we have seen is the fact that you are seeing a little more of these political dissidents who were not allowed to travel now able to come to the United States and tell their side of the story. I think that's important. But what we have seen is, you know, even just last year, there was about close to 8,600, you know, political arrests in Cuba. The numbers keep increasing every year. So I think that inside of Cuba, there is this urge, this sense that if Raul Castro were to die, it could really just create a shakeup within Cuba. Although Raul has already made his next pick, which is a 40-something-year-old. They call him he's a communist, but he's what they would consider more of a reformer. I think he's probably just as dangerous as
what's his name?
Castro. I'm going to get his name right now. It's Miguel.
Is the torture and execution still going on?
What we do know, and Amnesty reports on this as well, the political persecutions are still happening. I mean, they are throwing people into jail time and time and time again. Is it reported that there's tortures? I'm sure that they're still torturing individuals. I'm sure that is still going on. I think that you're looking at the fact that individuals who even peacefully protest, one group, for example, is Damas en Blanco. They're very well known. They're the mothers of many of these political prisoners. They go out and peacefully protest. I mean, when I mean peacefully protest, they are literally walking on the streets and just praying, and they are beaten up by the Cuban police and military. They are thrown into jail. It's endless. So it is known that a lot of these individuals, and many times these political dissidents, some of them disappear and found dead. These are incidents that happen constantly.
Well, Mercedes, we're going to take a break. Mercedes Schlapp's talking about Cuba, where her father was put in jail for 6 years, tortured, lived to tell the tale, was named Mercedes as a result of his praying to the Virgin Mary there in the prison. When we come back, Mercedes, I'm going to ask you about Pope Francis. We'll be back right after this short break. I am back with Mercedes Schlapp, who is a proud Cuban-American, as she said, Fox News contributor, former member of the George W. Bush administration, married Matt Schlapp while they were together in the White House. They have five beautiful girls, and they have their own political consulting business called Cove Strategies. I've known Matt and Mercedes since before they got married, and I'm very proud of all that they've done. We started talking about her father, Jose, who still with us, but was a prisoner for 6 years, came to the U.S. and started over again from scratch. And how many brothers and sisters do you have?
Older brother, younger sister.
Three of you. And what are their names?
Yeah. So it's Jose, is my oldest brother, and then Melissa is my little sister.
Now, let's talk about the Catholic Church in Cuba, and let's talk about Pope Francis. You must have had a lot of conflicting feelings when Pope Francis went to visit Fidel Castro and applauded President Obama's announcement about normalization of ties with Cuba.
I have to say, Deal, I struggle because, obviously, as a practicing Catholic, I look to my Pope for guidance, and when I hear him just being being such an integral part of pushing forward this U.S.-Cuba deal, it makes me wonder. What bothers me, maybe not that part so much as it is the fact that the Pope himself had an opportunity to address and meet with political prisoners in Cuba. It never, ever happened. And that was hard to watch, is the fact that he went and almost kissed the ring of Fidel and Raul Castro, yet you have thousands of political prisoners in Cuba.
Catholics, too. I mean,
Catholics.
There for their faith.
Catholics who are there because they can't practice their faith, because they can't speak out freely. And the Pope just skipped over them and did not even really address the issue. And so that's the part that I find difficult to understand. I could see why he's thinking, well, open up relations with Cuba, let's have more dialogue. I could see that part. The part that's difficult for me is to understand why the silence on the political persecutions, on the human rights violations, on the fact that these individuals have that the Castro brothers have been part of a brutal dictatorship and really oppressing their people.
Well, he's not silent on climate change.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely not. And so, of course we know that, you know, the Pope is talks about the importance of being Christ-centered and helping the poor. But I just felt that was very difficult for me to watch, to know that he did not really stand up to these two dictators.
Well, what's the difference in the Catholic Church in Cuba before Castro and now afterward?
Well, my parents went to Catholic school. They all through high school, from elementary to high school. It was, you know, the nuns teaching them. It was a vibrant, vibrant community. And you have to understand, so many Spaniards immigrated to Cuba. Many Catholics who went to Cuba brought the religion, obviously the missionaries. Catholicism is so ingrained in the Cuban culture. And what we have seen is under the Castro regime, we've seen 2,000 churches were declared illegal, and this would be also, Christian churches as well. 100 of them were designated for demolition by the Castro regime. That's astonishing. The fact that students don't have a choice to go to a school and be able to pray and practice their religion and learn about their faith, that the only way they can do that is if they go to their churches or go to their parishes, which are under extreme scrutiny by the government. My aunt always tells me stories about in their community, there was the watchdog. There was a communist watchdog, a communist spy who would live in the community. The government would pay them money, and that person would be the one who would basically say if you're on the nice list or the naughty list. And they would report back to the government on who was being critical of the government or doing something that they shouldn't, you know.
So there is a church there. It's about 300 parishes, about 350 priests. There's about, they say there's 12 some sort of centers of Catholic education with 1,000 students, 78 seminarians. But they're all under constant watch.
Constant watch, yes. And I find it interesting. I mean, obviously the bishops can't really speak out. There is this silence that there is this sense that they stay just quiet, don't ruffle anyone's feathers, so that they can keep the parishes open. But there's clearly definite surveillance from the government on the Catholic Church.
So you will never go back until what happens? Under what circumstances would you take your family, perhaps even your dad? Is your mother still alive?
My mother, yes, she's still alive.
Yeah, and maybe even your mother. When would you, under what circumstances would you go back? Because I'm sure you'd like to.
Yes, I would love to. I mean, my grandfather's buried there. Obviously my parents were married in Cuba. I really would go back when I start to know that there could be free elections there, when we see the release of political prisoners. That's when I would go back. I think when we would start seeing a true free Cuba, where the government and the military is not the only one that benefits from American dollars coming into their pockets. And that's really what, you know, and that's where I do hope to see that one day. I really do.
Do you think you'll see it in your lifetime, Mercedes?
Yes, I do. I have hope. I think that once the Castro regime and Raul Castro is dead, and I know we talked about this earlier, but they're mentioning the Miguel Díaz-Canel is his name. He's in his 40s. He considers he's a communist, but more of a reformer. I mean, if he is a leader who he's not attached to that revolution.
He could be their Gorbachev.
1950s. He could be their Gorbachev, or someone else could rise and be their
right.
Gorbachev. I don't trust Miguel Díaz-Canel. I don't trust him, but I do think, and he obviously has been indoctrinated by the Castro brothers, but I think that I would have hope that there would be a chance of a leader rising up and an opportunity for there to be truly free elections in Cuba.
Well, when you read about the inner circle of Stalin or Khrushchev, none of these guys knew what the other guy was really thinking, ever. So I'm sure that Raul Castro has no true idea or accurate idea of what's really in the mind of any of the young men surrounding him. They all keep their own counsel because they want to stay alive.
Right.
They want to stay out of prison.
That's right. That's
so there might be hope there. You never know.
I do believe that. And I think it's really important for, you know, people of faith to understand. I mean, for Fidel Castro and the Castro brothers, the church was considered to them the enemy of the revolution. And he focused on abolishing the church activities. He would set many of the priests across the island underground, and the government did take control over these churches. And so I think that with the Castro brothers out of there, the church has an opportunity to rise up and be a voice for the people and hopefully push for significant change. But it's difficult, again, as we saw with Pope Francis, that he did not take that opportunity to be a voice for the political prisoners.
We have a new administration coming in, and you're you know all the players. What do you think the Trump-Pence administration's, and I'm not asking you to go out on a limb and, you know, get ahead of, you know, the powers that be, but what's your general idea of what will be the new administration's attitude, policy toward Cuba?
I think Donald Trump has the right vision. He understands that you can't get a deal without really getting anything in return. And that's what President Obama did. So President Obama asked Raul Castro to release 50 political prisoners. Well, Raul Castro did that. He released 50, but he arrested over 100 in 1 month. So it really is not a deal. I mean, it's just Obama's way of checking the box off that, oh, things are, relations with Cuba are better. And so I think for Donald Trump, he's a deal maker, but he wants to be in the position of strength. And he's sending a very clear message to Castro that, look, you're going to have to make some changes in the way you lead in order for us to have this dialogue. And that will include releasing political prisoners and moving towards more political and religious freedoms. And I think that is a very fair deal to ask for. I don't expect Donald Trump to cozy up to Castro or go eat a hot dog at a baseball game with him. You know, I think once a dictator, always a dictator, and I think Donald Trump understands that. And it's why so many Cuban Americans in Miami and in South Florida rejected Hillary Clinton and rejected Obama because of this weak policy that they pushed on Cuba. And that's no surprise that 58% of Cuban Americans voted for Donald Trump because they know that he would at least be tougher against the dictator than what we have seen under this administration.
Raul Castro is 85. So let's assume he's only got a few years left. And by the way, according to the Internet, his net worth is over $100 million. I wonder where that came from.
Yeah, exactly.
But you say he's as bad as his brother?
Well, my father had this expression, and he would say that Fidel Castro would order the executions and Raul Castro would pull the trigger.
Really?
And that's, I mean, that was the type of relationship that the brothers had. He was known as really being the one to execute, he himself, many of the political prisoners. So there is, you know, blood on his hands. It's clearly, he should not be considered that he's the nicer brother. That just does not exist. He runs Cuba with a tight fist the same way that his brother did. Difference is that Fidel Castro was that, just bigger than life, figure, right? He was the one that would give the speeches for where he would order the Cuban people that they better show up to his speeches to listen to him or else. And his speeches would last easily 4 hours, 5 hours. And he was just a very different political figure than Raul Castro. Raul Castro is a bit more awkward. And he's not what you would consider, you know, he wasn't considered the main driver of the revolution or the orator. He was more of the doer. But again, very, just as destructive as his brother.
Well, anybody that carried out those kind of orders is not anybody you want to trust at all. Talking with Mercedes Slapp, whose father was a very successful businessman in Cuba, in 1972, he got out of a Cuban prison and came to the United States. His name is Jose Viana, and he's now 81, and as Mercedes says, strong as an ox. She woke him up to tell him that Fidel Castro had died, and you said that your dad teared up. It's a complicated thing when you're dealing with somebody who has wrecked so much havoc on your life and the life of your family. Do you think he wished for Fidel Castro's death?
You know, that's a real personal question. I don't even know if I even would have asked him. I think the question, it's interesting because
Is it too personal to ask?
I'm sorry?
Is it too personal
to
ask?
No, it was interesting because he did say to me, he goes, well, I didn't necessarily want him to die just peacefully in his bed.
He wanted to know he died.
Right. He just was like, I think we would have preferred to see something else happen. But, you know, I think that one thing about my father, which he has taught me, and it's something I've taught my children as well, is para adelante, which means moving forward. You need to move forward. He doesn't sit back and reminisce on what could have been or what should have been. No. It was God's plan. We move forward. And I think it's why he came here with nothing, then became, you know, briefly a carpenter, an electrician, and then eventually built a successful business here in the United States, raised his kids in a, you know, very middle-class upbringing, but he was able to get us through all Catholic school. And so he doesn't think back of what could have been. It is what it is. And it's unfortunate, and so many millions of people have suffered, so many millions of Cubans have suffered. And so it's our responsibility, and it's my responsibility to ensure that sort of awful government never, ever comes to America. And that is why I feel so strongly that God calls me every day to tell a story and to explain why we have to fight for our freedoms, fight for our religious freedoms, fight for our political freedoms, because we're always too close to just losing them deal.
And what happens when you're face-to-face with someone who idolizes Fidel, thinks he's this, you know, champion of freedom? How does that conversation, debate, or argument go down?
Well, it never goes well. It never goes well.
Do they ever see your point? Do they ever give any ground? Or?
I think they can, but I think when you're so blinded by the indoctrination of the left and the indoctrination of socialism and communism, I think it's very hard to change your view, right? I think it's difficult. And I sometimes feel that it takes you to lose something, like in the case of my parents that lost so much, to really appreciate what you have. And so, you know, it's never pretty to try to debate a communist, or they're going to have their ideals, and they're going to think that it's the right way. You know, they're going to view capitalism as evil. They're going to view democracy as being unfair. But I'll tell you, I'll take our system over their system any day.
You know, I was in China a couple of years ago, and I had a wonderful, very educated young guide, about 27, lovely lady. We were standing in Tiananmen Square, and I asked her where the tank was that day when it rolled up against that young man who stood in front of it. And she said, "What tank? What are you talking about?" She had never heard the story.
Oh, Lord. Mm-hmm.
And I then said, "Well, what about the millions that died?" Because we were looking at Mao's tomb and all the hundreds of people lined up to go in. "What about the millions that died?" "Oh, that's a myth. That never happened. That's just U.S. propaganda." I mean, they are still educated in China to think of Mao as a benevolent freedom fighter.
Right.
And but, you know, and it's amazing to me that someone this intelligent, this good in English language would completely miss it. And that's what you're talking about. I mean, we have Americans who think this way, correct?
That's right. I mean, it's so interesting. I think part of it is, you know, you look at China, for example, the censorship there, the inability for them to have access to internet or to information, it really does impact the way they view their history and the way they view even current events. And so, you know, I think, you know, this is why sometimes I worry about this draw towards socialism here in America, right? I see the millennials, and it, you know, there was this fascination with a Bernie Sanders character of free this and entitlement. You're entitled to free college and entitled to free, you know, health care.
We'll pay off your school loans.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, Deal, it worries me because I think this is when it gets too dangerous. When government encroaches in your life and government makes so many decisions that for you, and you feel that you don't need to work hard or to be or to really make those sacrifices to improve your life. And so I find it that I think it's an important message to tell the youth of saying, look, work hard. Our system, while it is not perfect, it is in the most successful government in modern history. It really allows for debate. You know, look at our election system. It's ugly, not pretty. But you know what? It allows...
Nobody gets thrown in jail.
Exactly. We see a simple transfer of power, hopefully. It gives us an opportunity to have different people debate each other with very different ideas. But this idea that in the terms of a Cuba where you can only learn one way or think a certain way, which is the Fidel Castro communist way, and your life will be threatened if you don't follow that rule, it's horrific.
By the way, Mercedes, one thing I learned in doing my homework for you is that Fidel Castro strongly urged the USSR to nuclear attack the United States because he was convinced the United States was going to send nuclear missiles at him. And it was Khrushchev who just said, no, we're not going to start a third world war over Cuba. But he was absolutely belligerent about demanding that nuclear bombs be launched against the United States. I guess you knew that.
Yes, and it was always in Fidel Castro's rhetoric, right? It was this idea that the Yankees were evil, and the fact is he called it the imperialist aggressiveness of the U.S. And that was the type of rhetoric he used, even talking to his own people, and it really established the sense of the United States being the bad guy for Fidel Castro. So he did have. In his mind, I mean, he did have the sense of what is the way that this dictator could destroy the superpower. And that was something, it is one of the reasons why for so long he just would make it a point to be so critical of the United States, because he feared that any influence of the United States could create an instability in Cuba, which he was trying to avoid. It is one of the reasons why he was petrified of even the Cuban-American community. Very successful in South Florida,
right.
Very powerful, and the fact is he did everything he could to ensure that they would try not to influence Cubans within the island.
Did he have spies within the Cuban community in South Florida?
You know, I know that several spies were arrested here in the United States who worked. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there was definitely the sense of infiltration of Cubans who came to the United States who were spies. It was actually, you know, you saw the Cuban spy exchange when it was Alan Gross, and they released the USAID officer from Cuba, and they made that exchange of the Cuban spies here in the United States. Oh, yes, it was very much, it was very clear that he had this sense of paranoia, and he did throughout his reign or throughout his dictatorship, that he would basically ensure that, you know, that he would get as much information as he could from here, from the United States, to take back to Cuba.
So we have a few minutes left. I want to go back to this central question of Fidel Castro now being lionized by so many major TV networks, major news media, the old standards of the New York Times, Washington Post, and so forth, and especially from Europe. My God, I mean, they're just crazy over there, except now France seems to be turning around. What is it they don't get? I mean, I'm stunned. I mean, I watched my generation, many people I knew, get radicalized by the influence of Castro in the 60s and 70s. I knew all the time, and I wasn't that well informed politically, he was a killer. He was a Stalinist, you know. And what is it that they refuse to see? You know, what's the missing cog in the way they think about Fidel Castro?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there was this sense of Fidel Castro helping to end apartheid in South Africa, and the fact that he would send these Cuban doctors to Angola, for example, to help. And they talk about the fact that they have this, that the literacy rate and the is high in Cuba. And so I think the point that they miss, I think those on the left, and they miss, so there's a sense of this romantic figure of Fidel Castro. And what they do miss is the fact that while he was trying to end apartheid in South Africa, he was creating his own apartheid in Cuba. You know, the fact that his people have lived in poverty for decades. The fact that his people are not being able, there's no, you know, when you look at the economic indexes, I mean, Cuba is down at the bottom of the list with North Korea. Is there a sense of any of economic freedom of individuals being able to basically live, use their God-given talents to have a career and be successful? No. Why? Because there's only a certain number of those individuals that if they follow the party line, then yes, you might have an opportunity to succeed if you stick with Fidel Castro. But if you do not, or if you just stay in a situation where you're just trying to survive, it becomes a very difficult deal.
So, well, Mercedes Slapp, you know, I want to thank you for being on Church and Culture, and I know that you hope, the way I do, that this new administration will use the power and influence and leverage of the United States to actually address directly the human rights question in Cuba that President Obama never addressed.
That's right. Yeah, and I think that's something that you're going to see with Donald Trump and the new administration. I think there will be more of an emphasis and a focus on talking about political persecutions, talking about churches being demolished in Cuba, and I think it's an opportunity to be a voice for those Cuban people who at this point continue to be oppressed by the Castro regime.
Mercedes, thanks for all you do, and thanks for being such a great voice on Fox News and all
you
do.
Thank you for having me.
And I hope we'll have you back again later on in this administration to see how we're doing.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you for being a guest. And to all of you who are listening, I'll be back on this day at this time next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net. Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, well, he's gone and done it again. Pope Francis has said more things that have some people thinking and wondering. We turn to the Liturgy of the Eastern Churches to help us sort things out.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio. Fire on the Earth's Peter Herbeck on Living for God and for the World's Possessions.
Whatever they are, the things you want to possess and have in this world, we sometimes hide them from God. We don't want to bring them into our relationship with God because we're afraid He might say something. We don't want to hear about those things. You can't have both. And Jesus is saying, as long as you hold on to those things, you're not going to make progress. At the end of your life, when I call you home, the story of your life will have been written. It will be all there for my Father to see. What did you want in this world? Did you really seek God? Did you love God first? If you did that, there will be a glorious story that's communicated for all eternity. But friends, if we were half in and half out, or Jesus talks about as being lukewarm, that mainly our Christianity, our Catholicism, is kind of driven by a sort of slight sense of guilt, that's all going to be revealed. And there'll be tremendous sadness. And the scripture says we will pound our chests with regret and cry out, "What was I thinking?" So that's why the Apostle Peter says, strive, friends, make every effort. For if you do this, you will never fall. Embrace it. Run after it.
Peter Herbeck spreads fire on the earth, weekday mornings at 6:30 and again at 11:45 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Does your child have a temper? I hear that often in the office. I hear it often from parents in general. He has a temper. Ooh, she has a mean streak in her. Is this so? Can you teach a child to have a temper? I think so. As a matter of fact, more of the kids that I have met have been taught that they are allowed to have a temper than actually have a temper. Having a temper makes it sound like there's something deep within the child that is rearing its ugly head. To be sure, some kids are by nature more feisty than others, and some kids are more prone to push on you than others. But a very powerful factor in teaching a child that temper is allowed is allowing them. Most often, when I work with parents, I find that a natural temper reared its ugly head in the course of things years ago. And over the years, the temper has been allowed to express itself at least a good percentage of the time without too many consequences. So, after 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 years, we have children who look like they just have a temper. But maybe a better way to put it is that we have a child who learned a temper. I'm Dr. Ray.
On the next Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
We'll keep you closely connected to the faith with the latest from Rome, the front lines of the pro-life movement, and we'll also take a look at other crucial issues facing you and your family in our one holy Catholic and apostolic church.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. Through baptism and confirmation, we receive the Holy Spirit of power and truth, who then equips us for mission with ordinary and extraordinary graces and gifts necessary for the building of the kingdom. Sometimes those graces, though totally effective, lie dormant like chocolate in a glass of milk, waiting for our faith and understanding to stir them up. If left inactive, the chocolate often settles at the bottom of the glass. It's still there, but it's not imparting flavor to the milk. So what are we to do? Call upon the Holy Spirit and stir those graces out of the bottom into the milk of our lives. Invite the Holy Spirit into your life today, and He will continue to renew you and animate your life with power and love. Don't let your expectations limit the Lord and His Holy Spirit. Expect Him to act through you.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit. The FCC requires us to reduce our power at sunset. For those affected by this change, we invite you to listen on the internet at avemariaradio.net.
Thank you. Welcome to Divine Intimacy Radio, a co-production of EWTN Radio and SpiritualDirection.com, where we provide you with a spiritual haven of rest and explore the riches of the wisdom of the saints and the path to union with God.
This is Dan Burke with Melissa Elson for Divine Intimacy Radio, and we're grateful to serve you today. As always, our goal is to provide a bit of a haven of rest, a little radio retreat from all of the noise and tumult of our times and the difficulties of life, and to lift our eyes to heaven and our hearts to God so that we can gain better perspective regarding how it is that we survive and thrive. And Jesus called us to live in the world, but be in the world, but not of it. And so how do we do that? How do we have the peace that he calls us to? How do we live in the world but not be dominated by it? How do we know joy in the midst of suffering? All of these great themes of mystical theology, spiritual theology, is what we're about on the show. And today we're excited to continue talking about prayer. We have a few great questions. Before we jump into those, I want to just mention that you can get show notes for any of our shows on spiritualdirection.com, and show notes are summaries of the show, but also links to things that we might mention, books and that sort of thing. It's always can be helpful. You can also subscribe to spiritualdirection.com. You'll get daily insights. Is a similar flavor to Divine Intimacy Radio. In fact, spiritualdirection.com is essentially the mother, birthed Divine Intimacy Radio. And you can get daily wisdom in your email, but also there's links to avilainstitute.com, where we provide courses on the interior life to help you to grow spiritually, whether you want to do graduate courses or those on personal enrichment, on things like John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, how to grow in wisdom and virtue, to overviews of entire Western mystical tradition in the graduate program. It's really just an endless resource for those of us who, by God's great mercy, have been able to see and desire that great haven of rest and the life of abundance that Christ calls us to, even though we may be struggling or suffering. So, Melissa, we should probably start out with a follow-on question from one of our listeners regarding prayer from our last show.
Right. This is from Sarah in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. She says, in one of your shows, you mentioned that spending time with God in prayer was easy for you. Has that desire been a part of your life since your conversion, or did you eventually grow into it? I ask because I'm a convert, too, and I think I probably spend a similar amount of time a day in prayer, and yet I most definitely do not always feel like it. Once I pray, I'm always glad I did, but getting started is not always easy. Does it get easier to pray the way God asks you to pray?
Which is such a great question. The answer is, to the first question, is that you know, always been that way for me? And the answer is no. You know, when I first came to Christ, I'm Jewish by birth, and came to a recognition of Jesus as my Messiah when I was in my early 20s, and I had a radical conversion experience. And so I was very motivated at that time to begin a life of prayer and also daily Bible reading. I converted to Protestantism, evangelicalism, and of course Bible reading is very much a part of their spiritual regimen, daily devotions they called them. And so I would do that. I found prayer to be difficult from many standpoints then. One was that it's sort of a free-for-all, so there are some suggestions about how to do it, but I didn't, you know, they didn't have vocal prayer, of course. I didn't believe in that sort of thing, even though it's all over Scripture and the Psalms, and that, and it's what Jesus taught us to do when they asked.